Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order the Health and Human Services Finance Division. If everyone could please take your seats. We do have a quorum, right? No, we don't have a quorum yet. Okay, now we do have a quorum. Excellent. So we have a quorum, and we don't have minutes today. But, of course, we're here to start the process of consideration of our omnibus bill. And the omnibus bill is the A-19. Well, we have the omnibus bill. The underlying bill is House File 2414. But the way this process works, the substance of the bill is in an amendment, a delete-all amendment, which members have and is online for members of the public. And the amendment is coded A19-0349. So I'm going to move the A19-0349. So first we need to move the bill, okay, to get it before us. So I'm going to move House File 2414, that it be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And then I'm going to move the A19-0349 delete everything amendment. And so the process now will be that we will be talking about the delete everything amendment that I've just mentioned. And at the end of our process, hopefully either on Friday or on Saturday, we will be moving to adopt the DE as amended at that point. So from here on, amendments that will come later, I assume, in the process, will be to this delete all amendment. I want to just mention for members, the staff have worked very hard to give you the delete all amendment in a cover, in a ring binder for your convenience and use. They did not have time to put every member's name on your binder. So if you intend to write on this and keep it, which I assume most of you will want to do so that you can refer to it, please put a post-it note on it or something so that the staff will, at the end of this hearing today, the staff will put your name on it. But we want to make sure that if you put notes in it that it is linked back to you and you'll get the same book back again. Of course, you don't have to leave it with us. You can take it and work on it. That is up to you. But this is your copy. So, you know, everyone needs to keep track. Also, a certain lovely feature of this that Ms. Niedernhofer has made happen for you is that in the very back of this black binder, you have your spreadsheet. You also have a ruler, which will be, from my experience, could be very helpful to you in reading the spreadsheet. It's a kind of a special ruler, and without these, it can be really hard. These spreadsheets are difficult to read, and this should help. So take a look at that. So let's see. Did we cover everything we need to cover for now? I think we have. Yeah. And so our agenda for today, then, is to have our staff do a walkthrough of this spreadsheet and a walkthrough of the bill, and then we will take some testimony today, and starting with some testimony from our agencies, from the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, and we will take some public testimony today, and then our intention is to continue tomorrow with public testimony as well. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Berg and ask him to lead us through. And members, again, what we'd like to do with the walkthrough, it's not intended for a time to debate anything or question why something's in there. However, if you don't understand what's being said, if you don't understand what Mr. Berg is explaining about the spreadsheet, I think clarifying questions would be in order, as long as we can still just kind of move through this expeditiously. But the purpose of the walkthrough is so that members and the public get an opportunity to understand what is in the bill. And so to the degree you need to ask a question to understand what is in the bill, please do raise your hand. Thank you. So, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members, members should have in their packet a legal size spreadsheet that is 28 pages long. In the upper right corner, it is labeled HF2414DE, and in the lower right corner, it is dated April 1st at 3:02 p.m., so hopefully everybody has that same one. On page one, I'm just going to briefly pause on the top on line 7, and if you look to orient you on the spreadsheet, the left-hand six columns are the governor's numbers. The right-hand six columns are the House numbers. The shaded columns are the 2021 total and then the 22-23 total. So if you look on line 7 in the first shaded column for 2020 and 2021, this bill has net general fund spending, net of revenues, of $128.569 million above base. That matches the House's, the Ways and Means budget resolution, and is spending that is $21.730 million in net general fund spending, higher than the governor. In the tails, on the furthest right column, the general fund, there's general fund net spending of $116.871 million. Again, that is the governor plus $59.288 million. There is summary information by fund and by department on the rest of this page and the most of page two. I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over that, Madam Chair. And I'll try to mainly highlight the differences from the governor's budget. For the most part, the governor's budget is included in the House position, and so where those positions are the same, I will just skip over them and highlight the differences. I will, on the bottom of page 2 at the start of the Department of Human Services, I will make a note. The first item is part of the vulnerable adults package that is in House File 90, the language of which is in this bill. They're still working on the fiscal note, and that bill will need some further work. For now, the governor's numbers are included for vulnerable adults and effectively make the target for that bill as it gets worked on. So all those vulnerable adults items are at the governor's number. Moving ahead, Madam Chair, the first item of note is on page 4 of the spreadsheet. On line 151, this is the inclusion of the DHS portion of the Family Medical Leave Bill. This is programming costs for that item. And you'll see it costs $674,000 in 2021 and $230,000 in the tails. Moving on to page 5. I will just note these are not different from the governor's, but if you look at starting on page, on line 205, well, all I will say the various child care and program integrity items are at the governor's number and came out of House File 1801, which was Representative Dabney's committee, Pinto's committee report. The only difference from what Representative Pinto's committee reported out on child care is on line 205, which is Representative Pinto had slightly reduced the basic sliding fee child care number to accommodate some other items. This bill puts it back to the governor's number. So in all the items that came out of Representative Pinto's bill on child care and on child care program integrity are at the governor's number. Moving down to, that includes, I'll just highlight new items. On line 210, there was House File 2420, which is a grant to First Children's Finance that provides loans for child care businesses. Line 214, and that's $1 million one time in 2020 and 21. On line 214, there was what was originally House File 2264, the retained grants for $200,000 in 2020 and 21 and 22 and 23. These are grants that go to a nonprofit that help to retain employees. They're like longevity grants to help retain employees in child care businesses. And on line 218 is what was originally House File 2581, Representative Morrison's bill, that puts out $260,000 one time to food shelves for purchase of diapers. Moving on to page 6, I will go to line 227 on the spreadsheet. This is House File 930, which was Representative Kunesh-Podein's bill on TEFRA enrollment content to be developed by the department. That is $122,000 in 2021 and $126,000 in the tails. On line 232 is House File 1050, which was, I believe, Representative Moran's bill that alters background studies for family foster care. It is allocates $276,000 in 2021 and $286,000 in the tails. On line 237 is House File 2231. This sets up a rate, directs the department to create a rate methodology for substance use disorder. This was, I believe, Representative Cantrell's bill. It costs $177,000 in 2021 only. On line 242 is House File 563. This is the Heaven's Law bill, which is Representative Moran's bill. It has $27,000 of systems cost in 20 and 21. I should note that that bill took on an amendment when we were on the last day, and we still have a pending fiscal note, so this number may need to get adjusted slightly. On line 247 is House File 399 is Representative Noor's bill on Hennepin County foster care recruitment, which cost $75,000 in 2020 only. Line 251 is House File 2571, which is Representative Halverson's Pathways to Prosperity pilot program. It allocates $2 million in 2020 and 21 only. On line 255 is House File 1543. This is Representative Dean's background study set-aside criteria that allows a set-aside of disqualifications in background studies in certain instances for people trying to in substance use disorder counseling. On the very last line on page 6 is 259 is Representative Lesch's prescription price gouging legislation, which costs $534,000 in 2020 and 21 and $588,000 in the tails. I should note at the top of the next page a portion of that, the net general fund cost is allocated to DHS for a transfer to the Attorney General's office. On line 265 is Representative Mann's bill to reduce TEFRA fees by 15%. That has a cost of $2.5 million in 2020 and 21 and $3.1 million in the tails. On line 274 is Representative Edelson's bill to increase the tobacco sales age to 21. That has the $60,000 cost each year for staffing at DHS for reporting requirements in the bill. I should note on this that there will be, the question was raised by a member on whether there would be a revenue note on this, and there will not be. The Department of Revenue's view is this is not a tax law change, but a forecast issue, and so it will, the loss, there will be, of course, a loss of tobacco revenue, but it would, in their view, would show up in the forecast and not as a revenue change due to a tax law change. Line 278 is Representative Akam's step therapy override bill, which costs $1.7 million in 2020 and 21 and $2 million in the tails. On line 282 is Representative Moran's Parent Support Grants Program, which helps parents navigate the child welfare system. That is a $300,000 one-time cost in 2021. On line 286 is half of the Safe Harbor initiative. Members will remember that Safe Harbor exists at both DHS and at MDH. We'll come to another item. This was, I think, Representative Morrison's bill this year, or no, Representative Schultz's bill this year. There's $500,000 in 20 and 21 at DHS, which tends to handle housing and those sorts of issues. The items at MDH are more in the prevention and coordination area. We'll come to that in the MDH section. On line 290 is the Representative Lippert's Recovery Community Organization Grants item, which is $1 million in 2020 and 21 only. This has to do with peer support counseling for recovery. On line 294 is Representative Zerwas's bill, House File 1867, that creates a dispute resolution process between counties and DHS for the does not meet medical criteria discharge issue that the counties have with the department. This has a cost of $582,000 in each biennium. Moving on to page 8, at the bottom on line 333, is Representative Morrison's MA Asthma Care Services benefit item. It costs $1.1 million in 2020 and 21 and $2.2 million in the tails. On page 9, at the top on line 340, is Representative Bernardi's bill that includes MA coverage for weight loss drugs. That costs $900,000 in 2020 and 21 and $1.5 million in the tails. On line 347 is the House's version, Representative Schultz's bill on the DWS competitive workforce factor. If you'll note, just below this item is the governor's item. I've shown them separately here, so there are some differences in the way they are. So the House's $34.1 million cost in 2020 and 21 and 99.7 in the tails, you'll note, comes in about $6 million cheaper than the governor's item in 2020 and 21, but more expensive in the tails. Then we'll move to page 11 is the next item. On line 428. Is House File 963 is Representative Halverson's bill relating to coverage of 90-day supplies of contraceptives. It costs $4,000 in programming costs in 20 and 21 and nothing in the tail. On line 432 is Representative Mann's doula reimbursement bill. It changes the rate in MA. Cost $64,000 in 20 and 21 and $105,000 in the tails. On line 436 is House File 306. This is Representative Albright's bill on pediatric autoimmune coverage. This and the next item are part of the cost. We'll come to additional costs at the Department of Commerce at the end of the spreadsheet. For pediatric autoimmune coverage, the cost of DHS is $158,000 in 2020 and $210,000 in 2022-23. The next item on line 440 is House File 1041, Representative Poston's bill on ectodermal dysplasia coverage. Similar to the PANDAS bill, there will be an item at the Commerce Department at the end of the sheet. The DHS portion of this costs $45,000 in 2020 and 21 and $92,000 in the tails. Line 444 is House File 684, which is Representative Mann's Rare Disease Advisory Council bill. It allocates $300,000 in 2020 and 21. This is, you'll note on the line, this is appropriated to the Department of Human Services for transfer to the University of Minnesota, where the Rare Disease Advisory Council would happen. On line 448 is House File 2244. This is Representative Cleavehorn's bill that is it's an attempt to recognize energy improvement costs at nursing homes into the rate formula so that those facilities have a financial incentive to do energy improvements. And it has a cost of $250,000 in each biennium. On page 12 at the top is line 456. House File 1961 is Representative Lippert's bill that allocates some money to the Community Action Grants Program, $1 million in 2021 only, 2020 and 21 only. Line 460 is House File 952. This is the Southeast Mobile Crisis Team grants. It compensates them for the fact that they had started these and then the program went statewide without any additional expenditure 2 years ago, and so their money got spread across the state. Just then allocates $830,000 in each biennium to the Southeast Mobile Crisis Teams. On line 464 is House File 742 is the Children's Mental Health Grant Program, Representative Morrison's bill. This does part of it. That bill had three purposes in it. This is, if members will recall, there was eligibility for child care for parents where the child is on an MFIP-only case and the parent isn't currently eligible for child care, and so they would be on some basis for respite care if they were mentally ill. This allocates $400,000 in each biennium for that purpose. On line 468 is House File 1756, which is Representative Stevenson's Anoka County Youth Drop-In Program, which is working towards youth homelessness and mental health issues. There's $200,000 one time in 2020 and 21 for that. Line 472 is House File 1875, which is Representative Wozlowick's bill to give a grant to the Center for Victims of Torture, looking at their integrated care model. It is $1 million one time in 2020 and 21. On line 476, it says House File 1792. It's actually 792. If you look up that House File, you'll see it has to do with the Coochin County Airport, which is, even in 1,000 pages, is not in this bill. But House File 792 is the Mental Health Culturally Competent Providers bill, which it puts out a grant of $1 million in 2020 and 21 to foster mental health consultation services that are culturally competent. And on line 492, I'll just note, this is the governor's traditional healing item. This is the first of several items we'll come to, that the governor funded with the opioid stewardship fee in his main bill. The House has already passed House File 400, which deals with opioid spending. And so in this case and others where the governor has spent on opioid stewardship fee-related items, there is nothing on the House side. And whatever happens with that will be dealt with in the House File 400 conference, either is in the bill or will be dealt with in that conference. On page 13, we come to more on line 522 is another opioid stewardship item. You'll see it's not, the House does not have the money. It will be dealt with in House File 400. However, on line 522, or 28 rather, the opioid stewardship grants, There is a one-time grant in fiscal 20 of $1 million, which is a general fund item. Representative Olson had wanted to have some funding for three programs that could potentially run out of funding if they aren't funded right away, and so this is bridge funding to get to whatever House File 400 does. It includes the St. Gabriel's program and the ECHO programs and Wayfair? I think the Wayfair program, that several of which have been funded previously. Moving to page 15, just below line 581, you find an item that refinances between the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund on Medical Assistance. It has an expenditure of $4.6 million from the Healthcare Access Fund in 2020 and 21, and a savings to the General Fund and Medical Assistance of the exact same amount in 20 and 21, and nothing in the tails. On line 588 is House File 840, which is the ME coverage of adult dental non-surgical periodontal treatment. That is $2.3 million in 20 and 21 and $6.3 million in the tails. I'll just note on line 594, most members have probably heard about the federal compliance with the outpatient pharmacy rule. This is an item the governor had. It's in our budget. This is a federal compliance issue where we are under, the state of Minnesota is under threat of sanction from the federal government, and this needs to get done. I just wanted to highlight that item. And also I would note that the governor allocates money in 2019 for that item in the House budget. If you look at the numbers for 2020, they're slightly different. The House nets the fiscal 19 numbers into fiscal 20 because there is not an appropriation for 19 in this bill. The very last line on page 15, 607, is the housing needs item. This was House File 1043, Representative Cantrell's bill. There is $3 million in each biennium for that. If you go to the next page, it is for multiple purposes. And you'll see that it is on line 609, includes the long-term housing, homeless support services, on line 610, the Homeless Youth Act, and on line 611, the Emergency Services Grants Program. On line 613, and then the governor's item on line 619, this is the rate for durable medical equipment item. The governor's went to the federal rate, which saved a lot of money took a lot of money away from the providers. The House has some modified language that you'll note saves far less than the governor, and so it restores about $5.6 million of the governor's reduction in 20 and 21. A reduction of $2.2 million, and it restores about $900,000 of the governor's reduction in the tails, and House has only got a reduction of $300,000 in the tails. Moving to the bottom of page 17, there is on line 679 a study of healthcare financing, which costs $500,000 in 2020 and 21, one time. On page 18, on line 704, is Representative Howard's bill, House File 485, that establishes an insulin assistance program. This appears in two places, so this would be the expenditure. Will come at the Board of Pharmacy to the portion that raises the money. This is modeled very much on like the opioid stewardship fee, and raises funds in the state government special revenue fund at the Board of Pharmacy, and then expends them for insulin assistance at Department of Human Services here. This is $21.2 million in each biennium, and aside from a small amount of administration for department for DHS to administer the program, this would allocate the amount raised by the at the Board of Pharmacy by the fee. Moving to page 20, at the top, the line 758, this is the governor's service delivery transformation item that has to do with planning for future reconstruction of DHS IT systems. This item has been reduced in the House budget by $10 million. The governor's recommendation was $20 million. The House has 10. On line 762, I'll just note for information, this is the governor's Head Start background studies item. It appeared in both the K-12, E-12 and Human Services spreadsheets. It has no net cost. Staff have talked, and it so it's deleted from here, and it's included in the E-12 bill. Beginning at line 771 is the Department of Health. I'll just make the same note. The first several items are part of the Vulnerable Adults Package. Again, these are the governor's numbers in here. Effectively, the governor's spending for vulnerable adults is the target for that bill as we work it through. Moving to page 21, at the top on line 799 is the Comprehensive Advanced Life Support Education Program, House File 155, which is Representative Hewitt's bill. It costs $200,000 in each biennium. On line 803 is a portion, an item that was in House File 1, but came out of Representative Pinto's division report, House File 1801, and it just adds $500,000 one time to the home visiting state expansion program. Moving to line 440 is, 819, House File 440, is Representative Morrison's breast cancer screening item. This is actually going to have some revision, and I think this item, the cost of this item, will be going out of the bill because the department has revised its fiscal note. So just a note there. On line 828 is House File 1246. This is Representative Morrison's Prescription Price Transparency Act. It costs $1.6 million in 2020 and 21, and $1.4 million in the tails. Line 832 is House File 1176, which is Representative Zhang's bill for the TAP program. It's $5,000 one time in 2020. Page 22 at the top on line 836 is House File 1981, Representative Noor's bill that adds $2 million each biennium to the local public health grant base. On line 840 is House File 269 that has HIV prevention grants at the Department of Health for $1 million in 2020 and 21 only. House File 844, or rather, line 844, House File 479, which is the domestic violence prevention grants that are Representative Becker Finns, allocates $1.5 million to the department in 2020 and 21 only. On line 848 is the other half of Representative Schultz's Safe Harbor program. It's the same amount as at DHS, another $500,000 in 2020 and 21 only. Again, the MDH portion of Safe Harbor is the No Wrong Door program, the coordination, the planning, the education side of things, and whereas DHS has more of the housing for victims and that sort of thing. On line 852, House File 928 is an addition of $1 million each biennium for fetal alcohol syndrome prevention at MDH. On line 856, House File 940, is the Palliative Care Advisory Council. It's $88,000 in 2020 and 21 and only, although that item has been previously funded on a one-time basis. On line 865, I'll note the governor's item on 860 deals with network adequacy reviews. The House does that, and then on line 865 is House File 551, which does more work on network adequacy. And so that has an additional, well, it has a savings of $500,000 in 2020 and 21 and a cost of $216,000 in the tails. Due to the savings are due to the fees that are raised for getting waivers. And moving to page 23, on line 883, I'll note just above that on 879 is the governor's recommendation for medical cannabis out of the state government special revenue fund at the Department of Health. And then on line 883 is the additional work that changes that are in House File 766, Representative Edelson's bill, that makes further changes to the medical cannabis program and allocates an additional $241,000 in 2020 and 21 and $318,000 in the tails. Line 888 is House File 733. This was passed last year and is here again. This is the regulation of low-dose X-ray radiation, ionizing radiation for security screening purposes. This is corrections and county jails would be the main users. This bill, members may have seen this in public safety or corrections. It's coming out of that bill. It will stay in this bill. And it spends $135,000 in 2020. Again, this is state government special revenue fund money and $50,000 ongoing.
Yeah, Mr. Berger, excuse me, but Representative Baker needed a clarification.
Ma'am, just I want to get on the list for the end. I just have some questions at the end.
Oh, okay, surely. Yeah, please, if you need anything, let us know, and let us know you need to ask right away if you do. Thank you. Sorry,
all right,
Mr. Berger.
Madam Chair, almost done. Next item is on we come to the health licensing boards on page 24. The only thing of note at the health licensing boards is on page 25. All the boards are at the governor's recommended level, except for some changes at the Board of Pharmacy, which begins on line 976. First, I'll note again that there are opioid stewardship fee issues here, so the items the governor has on lines 984, 985, 987, and 988 are not in the House language or numbers, because those would be handled in the opioid stewardship bill, House File 400. There are two other changes that the House makes on line 982 is Representative Lippert's bill, House File 182. This is the prescription drug repository program. Again, members saw this last year as well. It costs $30,000 in state government special revenue fund money in 2020 and 21 and $28,000 in the tails. This is the Board of Pharmacy supports this, and this is the idea of establishing a place where unused, unneeded drugs could be put and recycled for use if they're still good. And then on line 983 is the revenue portion of House File 485, the insulin drug assistance program. Again, you'll see those negative numbers, that those represent revenue raised by a fee on the manufacturers, very much like in the opioid stewardship fee. As I mentioned before, there was an expenditure item at Department of Human Services that involved providing insulin assistance to people who need it with the same amounts, the net amounts raised after administrative expenses. And then, Madam Chair, go to page, well, I'll just note for members that beginning on line, page 26, the other general fund agencies are, again, like the Health Licensing Board, are all the same as the governor's recommendation, the EMS Board, the Council on Disability, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and the Ombudsperson for Families. Those follow the governor's rec. At the bottom of that page is MNSURE, where you see the same numbers as the governor. For this is where the health insurance premium subsidy and the health insurance premium tax credit are. In the following, on page 27, on beginning at line 1061, is the Minnesota Management and Budget section. This is where the revenue from the provider tax appears, as well as the two transfers in the governor's budget and in the House bill from the remaining funds in the premium security plan account, the first one going to the general fund and for $142 million, and the second going to the healthcare access fund is $281 million. And then begin the last department beginning at line 1082 is the Commerce Department. We have on line 1084 is House File 572. This is Representative Schultz's bill that establishes loss ratios for health carriers and their spending. It has administrative costs of $57,000 in 2020 and 21, and $56,000 in the tails. On the last page of the spreadsheet on line 1088 is Representative Mann's bill 728 that requires licensure of pharmacy benefit managers. It costs $129,000 in 2020 and 21, and it saves $132,000 to the general fund in 22 and 23. I will note that the language in the bill is slightly different than the language as it went through here. It raises the fee to $8,500. It's an annual renewal, and the expenditure does not include the Commerce Department's cost for rulemaking. Then on line 1095 and is the Commerce Department cost of the ectodermal dysplasia coverage item we had before. This is $733,000 in 2020 and 21 and $825,000 in the tails. This is reimbursement to private health care carriers for the medical costs related to this condition. And then on line 1099 begins the pediatric autoimmune coverage item similar to ectodermal dysplasia. It costs $209,000 in 2020 and 21 and $229,000 in the tails. Again, these are to defray private insurance costs for the medical costs of this condition. Madam Chair, that's the changes from the governor's items in the spreadsheet.
All right. Well, Mr. Berg, thank you very much. And I know you're probably going to hear me say this a number of times throughout this process, but we have amazing staff, and Mr. Berg is, I know every member who's worked with him over the years knows how hard he works, and it's pretty amazing how much he knows and how helpful he is on this whole process. I have several members on the list, and I just want to say before I call on anyone, the purpose today is just to clarify what's here. We're not going to debate anything. We will have plenty of time for that. Representative Baker.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, and it was back on page 11. It was actually Representative Mann's bill, House File 2244. I was trying to recall whether that was heard in committee. It's the nursing facility special energy assessment. Was that heard in our committee? I'm sorry?
Yeah. Representative Baker, that is Representative Cleavorn's bill.
Okay.
And no, that was not heard.
It was heard in long-term care.
It was heard in long-term care, I understand. Mm-hmm. So we did not hear it in our committee, but it was heard in the division of this committee. And just to note, Nets, thank you for that question, because, we have two subdivisions of this division. and they both heard bills that we did not actually hear, but that is indeed the purpose of having a subdivision. Were we to hear all those bills again, there'd be absolutely no purpose for doing that, and we would be able to get a lot less accomplished. So that is where that is coming
thank
from.
You.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just three quick clarifications. Is that end-of-life bill funding, that I think it was $800,000, is that in here? Did I miss it?
No, that is not in here,
okay,
Representative
good.
Grunhagen.
Second question. I know you support that. Anyway, the HMO tax going from 1% to 2%, that's not here either, right?
Mr. Berger, I don't believe it is.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure which one you're the one that the nonprofits pay
yep.
is in, but there is no cost related to that because at this point it says that a for-profit entity would pay this, but there are no such for-profit entities, so there's no cost or revenue related to it at this point.
So just clarification, so for the nonprofit HMOs, they're not going from 1% to 2%. They're currently at 1%.
No. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, the gross premium tax is at 1%,
yep.
and the provider tax
is
reinstated is at 2%.
Right, but we're not increasing the gross premium tax.
No.
In this bill. Okay. And last thing
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, last clarification. Is the $200 million reduction for nursing homes, is that in this bill?
I think I could address that, Mr. Berg. And Representative Grunhagen, we have accepted the governor's number on stemming the future growth of nursing home costs, yes.
Okay, so it is in here.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Berg?
One note on that, Madam Chair and members, is that is an item on that the long-term care division did amend that item slightly, and we're still pending a fiscal note.
Okay.
The assumption is the fiscal note will reduce those savings slightly, but I don't know how much yet.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Mr. Berg, so are we hoping to have that fiscal note before Friday?
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we're hoping.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen covered a couple of my questions, but I know that in the long-term care subcommittee that I'm on, we decided not to put together an omnibus bill and to just pass those bills up to this committee. But the child care committee did create an omnibus bill. Is that going to be heard separately, or is that... Or are they not creating an omnibus?
Well, Representative Munson, I don't think they created something formally considered an omnibus bill. They created a division report in which they put together several what had been individual bills, and we have included that in this. So that's the way that works. It becomes part of what we have here.
Okay.
So I believe that we took everything they gave us and put it in this bill. So, yeah, this is where... So in terms of this committee hearing it, we're hearing it as part of this delete everything amendment.
Okay. And I just want to point out, Madam Chair, that you said that this was going to be less than the omnibus prime bill, which was 996 pages. This one's 998.
Representative Munson, we will discuss that, but we're not debating it today.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For now, I'm just wondering what the tails target was for this bill.
Well,
Madam Chair,
ahead, Mr.
Representative Schumacher, there is not an official tails target. The budget resolution passed by the Ways and Means Committee does not address the tails.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from members? Okay, everybody understands the thing perfectly. That is great. Okay.
Go through one more time.
Okay. I'm sure that you can. You will do that, Representative Grunhagen. And now we're going to move to our second walkthrough is going to be with House Research walking through the language of the bill And again, you know, I've asked Mr. Chun, well, let me just give a little preparatory remark to this. When I first had my first opportunity to put together an omnibus bill, which was when I was a policy chair, I would say that was my only other opportunity, I learned something I didn't realize. And I just want to tell all of you in case you don't know, maybe you already do. The individual bills that come through the committees, when you put them into an omnibus bill, they don't look like individual bills anymore. What happens is the language in them gets put into the order of the statute books. So it can make it kind of difficult for members to follow and find your bill. And so House Research puts together all kinds of aids for us to be able to do that. But it's not really that comprehensible. Like, you can't read through this thing like a book. You know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense if you do that. So I just want you to understand that. So I've asked Mr. Chun today to just kind of go through the articles, kind of tell us briefly in a general way what's in there, and then talk about anything that is new. I think that's what his intention is, because otherwise we could be here, as you know, for a very, very long time just reading through a document that they've given us in writing. So everything is available in terms of what the different provisions are, the different sections that are changed in the bill, and what they relate to is all available, but it would be very long and not really comprehensible to just read through that, if you understand. So we're going to have him do the walkthrough, hopefully a bit more quickly, a bit more comprehensively, or understandably, I should say, than that, and we'll see. So again, I guess what I would do is ask members at the end of each article, if you have questions, just clarifying questions, we could pause for a moment and ask those. But once again, we're not going to debate any of this today. Okay, so with that, I would ask Mr. Chun to, or Ms. Sunderman, please, go ahead.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just before we start, House Research will be working off of the Health and Human Services bill list for your reference. So Article 1, very generally, makes changes to the Child Care Assistance Program, various child protection provisions. There's one change in the child support provisions, and it increases the cash portion of the MFIP transitional standard. And in the article, what I'll do is just highlight items that were not included in the governor's budget.
And Ms. Sunderman, I'm not sure, do all the members have this document? Okay, just wanted to check. All right, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So beginning with sections 1 through 3, 5 through 6, and 8 through 20, these are from House File 2575, which was authored by Representative Pinto. And these make changes throughout to the CCAP program, including some federal compliance changes and an increase for the maximum provider reimbursement rate. There is some overlap with the governor's proposal within that language. Sections 4 and 7 are from House File 2651 from Representative Pryor, and that modifies CCAP by requiring technical assistance for providers and requiring counties to provide applicants and recipients with fraud prevention information. Section 21 is from House File 2264, and these are retain grants for early educators. Section 22 is from House File 563 as amended. This is Representative Moran's bill. This was Heaven's Law for interstate sharing of child protection information. Skipping to sections 25 and 26, those are from House File 2217 from Representative Pinto, and these sections relate to the removing the 20% withhold for child protection grant allocations. Skipping to sections 39 through 41, those are also related to Heaven's Law. Sections 43 and 44 are the Child Welfare Training Academy and Child Welfare Caseload Study sections. This is primarily governor's language. There is an addition that requires certain content for the training, and that is from House File 499, the first engrossment. And Section 45 is the from Representative Pinto's division report, and that is grants to First Children's Finance for childcare site assistance. That concludes Article 1. Questions?
Right, I'm not seeing any, so I think we can continue.
All right, I'll also be going over Article 2, which is the operations article. This article, again, very generally, makes changes to DHS operations, including licensing and some child care licensing and training changes, changes to the background studies chapter, and program integrity measures. And so going through, let's see, I think what I'll do is go through and just point out some of the bigger bills that were not either in Representative Pinto's division report or the governor's bill, in the interest of time. So Sections 8 and then Section 75 and 76, you'll see, are from Representative Dean's House File 1543, and this is the background study set-asides for individuals in the substance use disorder treatment field. Let's see. So then skipping to Section 29 and Section 31, these are licensing provisions from Representative Moran's House File 1050, which is the family child foster care licensing denial and sanctions for certain background study information. Let's see, skipping to Section 40, that is from Representative Pinto's division report, that is requiring DHS rather than providers to develop child maltreatment reporting policies in child care. Section 41 is also from the division report, and that relates to child care licenses and whether the phone number has to be displayed for the licensing agency. Section 42 is also from the division report, and that relates to that allows for supervision of a family child care provider's own child by an individual who is not licensed under certain circumstances. Section 45 is also from House File 1050, Representative Moran's bill, and that relates to the review of information relating to non-disqualifying background study information for family child foster care. The next several sections deal with child care training and licensing requirements. There's some updates and consolidation for those. Section 50 was in the division report, and that relates to emergency preparedness plan requirements. It's a federal compliance change, and that appears three times, I believe, in this article for each different type of child care license. Section 54 is from the division report, and this relates, and it was also in the governor's bill, but it was slightly different. So we incorporated the division report language for substitute caregivers, increasing the number of hours per year a substitute can provide care in family child care, and a provision related to emergency replacements in family child care. Let's see. If we skip to sections 63 to 66, section 69, 74, and 77, these are all also from House File 1050, Representative Moran's bill. They relate to changes to the language regarding FBI fingerprint retention and other background study requirements for licensed family and child foster care. Sections 81 to 83 are from Representative Pinto's division report dealing with CCAP fraud investigation program integrity. And the next several sections are mainly program integrity for both for general human services programs and medical assistance. And that concludes the main portions of Article 2.
Okay. I think we can go on to direct care and treatment.
Okay, well, this article is much shorter. So we have Article 3, which covers direct care and treatment. The only provisions in this article that are not from the governor's bill are from House File 1867, Representative Zerwas's bill, the DE2, establishing administrative review of county liability for the cost of care for days spent in direct care and treatment facilities after discharge is appropriate. And that concludes Article 3.
Okay, so great. So Representative Zerwas kind of owns Article 3. Okay, Article 4, continuing care.
Madam Chair and members, Article 4, continuing care, sections 1 to 12, 14 through 18, and 20 to 34 are House File 2548. These are the changes to the value-based reimbursement statutes. Section 13 is adult protection grants. This was in the governor's bill. I just want to note for members, the governor had this location in its own separate article, and the House just moved it to the continuing care article. And Section 19 is language from House File 2244. This is the pilot projects for energy programs and nursing facilities.
Okay, quick and easy. All right, I think we can go on to disability services.
So, Madam Chair and members, Article 5 contains provisions related to the DHS disability service programs. So for the provisions that are not in the governor's bill, Section 16 is House File 748, Reps of Man. This reduces the TEFRA parental contribution. Section 28 is House File 1388, Reps of Hornstein. This provides prescription coverage for persons living with HIV, and this is also a governor's proposal. Then Section 29 is from House File 1264, Representative Cantrell. This is a housing access grant modification. Section 30 of this article, this is a new provision. This requires PCA providers required to use the MA rate increase from the collective bargaining agreement for wages and benefits. Then Section 31 is from House File 1225, Representative Schultz. This is a direct care workforce report. Then a number of sections, Sections 34 to 47, 61, 63, and part of 64 are from House File 168, Representative Schultz. These are the disability waiver rate system modifications. Then moving to Sections 49 to 50, these are new provisions. They require community-first services and support providers to use the rate increase resulting from the collective bargaining agreement for wages and benefits. Then Sections 51 and 62 are from House File 1285. Modifies the consumer-directed community support program to allow shared services. Then Section 53 is House File 2122, Representative Nelson. This ratifies the direct support services collective bargaining agreement. Section 54 is House File 2094, Representative Liebling. This increases the direct support services provider reimbursement rates. Section 59 of the article is new. This requires a direct care workforce rate methodology study. And then Section 60 is from House File 930. This includes TEFRA option improvement measures. And that concludes the walkthrough for Article 5.
Okay. All right, let's move on then to Article 6, Chemical and Mental Health.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 deals makes changes throughout the chemical and mental health statutes. It provides some language for mental health grants, both for cultural competency and schooling mental health, makes changes to provisions relating to community behavioral health clinics and substance use disorder treatment room and board payments. It includes the governor's transition to community initiative, includes changes to psychiatric residential treatment facility provisions, and it includes provisions establishing behavioral health homes and medical respite homes as statewide benefits. So to go through sections that are not included in the governor's language, in Section 1, this is from House Bill 792. This is providing for culturally competent mental health provider grants. The next several sections are from the governor's bill. Skipping to Section 15, this is House File 1875, and this is the Center for Victims of Torture Mental Health Case Management Integrated Care Model Pilot Project. And Section 18 is partially the governor's language on expanding psychiatric residential treatment facility capacity, and partially from House Bill 1888 as amended. Sections 20 to 30 are from House File 1281, the first engrossment, and these relate to behavioral health homes and medical respite health home services. Skipping to Section 34, we have this section establishes a per provider rather than statewide per diem rate for psychiatric residential treatment services, and this was from House File 1888, the first engrossment. And the rest of this article was included in the governor's bill. That concludes Article 6.
Okay. All right. Not seeing any questions on that, so we can go on to Article 7.
Madam Chair and members, to be very brief about Article 7, this is the Mental Health Uniform Services Standards article. In general, this article makes a lot of changes to simplify and streamline standards for publicly funded mental health services. A lot of the changes you'll see in this article in the language are conforming changes to change cross-references throughout statutes. The article also creates Chapter 245I to consolidate a lot of the standards for mental health services, and the article also modifies mobile crisis response services. And that is Article 7.
Okay, thank you. All right, Article 8.
So, Madam Chair, Article 8 is the health care article. So this article contains provisions related to the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs. Sections 3 to 4 are from House File 815, Representative Acom, and this requires MA and Minnesota Care to offer a step therapy override process. Sections 8 to 12 are from the governor's bill, and they deal with hospital payments. And I just want to note that this article, I think other articles, contain sort of technical or other edits made by the Department of Human Services. So sections 9, 11, and 12 of this article are new provisions being suggested by DHS. Then moving to section 18, this is House File 840, Representative Lean. This provides MA coverage of services to treat periodontal disease. Then House File 20, Section 20 is House File 926, Representative Bernardi. This would include drugs for weight loss in the medical assistance drug formulary. Then Sections 26, 35, and 38 are from House File 725, Representative Fisher. These sections established an alternative payment methodology for federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics. Sections 27 and 29 are from House File 1535 of Sid Morrison. It provides an enhanced asthma care benefit under medical assistance. Then Section 33 is House File 259, Reps of Man. This increases MA payments for doula services. Section 34 is a new section. This deals with payment for durable medical equipment and other items, and it's related to the Medicare upper payment limit. So basically, these sections would provide the reduction up front rather than under current law where there's a delayed take back of the overpayment. And then finally, Section 39 is a repealer section, but this includes the repealer from House File 2459 with Sebel Offler. So this is the repeal of the sunset of the Minnesota Care Provider Tax. And that concludes Article 8.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chun. I think we can forge ahead.
Okay. Article 9, this is the One Care article. Sections 22 to 24 and 26 are from House File 2380, Representative Schultz, and these establish a state premium tax credit. Sections 3 to 6 are from House File 2359, also Representative Schultz, and these would require the Minshew Board to establish and administer a premium subsidy program. And then quite a few of the following sections are from House File 3, Representative Liebling, and these are essentially the governor's, you know, One Care proposals, where it requires the department to contract with a dental administrator, would exclude coverage from the managed care contracts. It increases dental payment rates by 54%. And also eliminates critical access dental and other dental rate add-on payments, would require DHS to administer an outpatient drug program, and then it established the One Care buy-in, offering a platinum product statewide and silver and gold products in an area with market failure. And then going back to sections 14 and 15, these are from House File 273, Representative Schultz. This provides Minnesota care eligibility for persons affected by the Affordable Care Act family glitch. And then Section 30 is a new section. This requires the Department of Human Services to develop a plan for an outpatient pharmacy benefit that would be available to enrollees of health plan companies that, you know, want to voluntarily participate in this program. Section 31 is also new. Requires the Department of Health to contract with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health to study a unified healthcare financing system and compare this to the current healthcare financing environment. And that would be Article 9.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious on this question, on this section, Article 9 for One Care, why none of the governor's provisions were adopted. Why was it all different, or what was the reason?
Mr. Chun, do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, House File 3 contains, I would say, you know, the bulk of the governor's One Care provisions. It was just, you know, introduced, I guess, earlier at a different time. And that's the language that moved to the process, and that's the language that was, I guess, amended in the various committees. But it's essentially the same concept. It's the governor's proposal.
Yeah, that's correct. So I just amended the governor's proposal onto House File 3 that started out as a Minnesota Care buy-in, and it just traveled separately under that. So, you know, it's been amended a bit through the committee process, but it is essentially the governor's proposal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one clarification. On that Minnesota Care buy-in, is there a maximum with the federal poverty level that you buy in at? Is there a maximum income amount?
Representative Grunhagen, we're not doing a Minnesota Care buy-in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Representative Grunhagen, if you're referring to the governor's One Care plan,
right.
Yeah, we're not going to discuss this today,
but
we'll hold that, those, you know, any questions, and in fact, you know, you may wish to talk with staff about that too, but today we're just walking through to kind of tell you what's here, and we'll discuss the meat of it later on in this process. Representative, or Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair and members, so Article 10 contains a wide range of provisions related to prescription drugs. Sections 1, 22 to 23, and 30 are from House File 4, Representative Lesch. This would prohibit manufacturers and wholesalers from charging an unconscionable price for an essential prescription drug. It would allow the Attorney General and individuals to bring actions and also classify violations as grounds for disciplinary action by the Board of Pharmacy, and then requires the reporting of certain price increases. Then Sections 2, 20, and 26 to 27 are from House File 687. Representative Bonner. These sections allow emergency refills if certain conditions are met, and they also would allow the synchronization of refills at least once a year. House files, sections 3, 38, 5 to 17, and 39 deal with PBM licensure, so it establishes requirements for PBMs, assigns fiduciary and other duties. There are requirements related to network adequacy, transparency, and ownership interests. Sections 3 and 38 would also establish refill times for specially mail order drugs. Then sections 18 to 19 and 21 are from House File 485, Representative Howard. This would require health boards to encourage their licensees to provide patients with information on how to obtain drugs at lower costs, and requires the Board of Pharmacy to provide drug resources on its website. Then sections 28 to 29, 36 to 37, and 40 are also from House File 485. They require insulin manufacturers to pay an insulin registration fee, would require DHS to establish an insulin assistance program, and creates an insulin account in the Special Revenue Fund. Section 31 of the articles from House File 182, Representative Lippert, requires the Board of Pharmacy to establish a drug repository program. Sections 32 to 35 are from House File 1246, Representative Morrison. This is a drug transparency requirements related to the reporting of drug price information, and the Department of Department of Health would post this information and report annually to the legislature. And that would conclude Article 10.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chun. Health-related licensing boards. Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair and members, Article 11 deals with changes to the health-related licensing boards. It modifies fees for the following boards by moving the fees from rule to statute, adding new fees in some cases, or increasing fees. And the professions it modifies fees for are the nursing home administrators, midwives, naturopathic doctors, genetic counselors, professionals licensed by the Board of Optometry, the Board of Occupational Therapy, the Board of Psychology, Board of Social Work, Board of Dentistry, Board of Pharmacy, and athletic trainers. The article also establishes emeritus dental licensure, which was in the governor's budget bill and also in House File 785. And House sections 21 to 46 are from House File 1718, the first engrossment, Representative Baker's bill, making a wide range of Pharmacy Practice Act policy modifications. And then Section 47 of the article is new language, which requires, I believe, at least quarterly audits to monitor for compliance in the prescription monitoring program with permissible use and data access requirements. And that concludes Article 11.
All right. Thank you very much. Article 12.
Madam Chair, Article 12 is the Health Department article. Beginning with Sections 1 and 8, these are from House File 1058, Representative Halverson. These direct certain litigation proceeds to be deposited in a tobacco use prevention account and used for those activities. Sections 2, 3, 51, 52, 58, 65, 66, 68, 69, and 74 authorize the sale of industrial hemp to medical cannabis manufacturers and establish requirements for hemp in the medical cannabis statutes. Sections 4 and 5 are from House File 733, Representative Tapke. This is the Health Department regulation of security screening systems. Section 6 was from 1846, Representative Sandell. This was also in the governor's budget. It increases the annual drinking water service connection fee. Section 7 regarding statewide tobacco cessation services was from House File 350, also in the governor's budget. Sections 9, 10, 75, and 77 to 86 were from House File 331, Representative Edelson, increasing the tobacco sales age to 21 and modifying penalties. Section 11 is Representative Liebling's House File 927 regarding swing bed days. Section 12 is Representative Edelson's House File 910, continuing the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. Section 13 is another medical cannabis provision authorizing the Health Department to use the Health Enforcement Consolidation Act to enforce medical cannabis statutes. Sections 14 to 42 and 88 are Representative Akam's House File 1516 changes to home care provider statutes. Sections 43 to 46 are new, and these make modifications to the Positive Abortion Alternatives Program. Section 47 is from House File 1226, Representative Bonner, and this codifies in statute a rider from previous law regarding home visiting for pregnant women and families with young children. Section 50 is from House File 479. It establishes a domestic violence and sexual assault prevention program. Sections 53, 59, 61, and 64 make additional changes to the medical cannabis program. As with sections 54, 57, 60, 62, 63, 67, and 70 to 72. Actually, as with everything on the rest of this page. And then the last elements in the Health Department article are from the governor's bill. So that's the end of the Health Department section.
Thank you. Article 13.
Article 13, Madam Chair and members, is the health coverage article. Sections 1 to 3, 15, 23, and 49 modify loss ratio requirements for health plans, establish net earnings requirements for nonprofit HMOs. Sections 4, 5, 7, and 39 are from House File 1041, Representative Poston, established requirements to cover treatment for ectodermal dysplasias. Section 6 is House File 440, Representative Morrison, provides for coverage of digital breast tomosynthesis. Sections 8, 38, and 47 are from House File 306, Representative Albright, provides for coverage for treatment of pandas and pans. Sections 9, 12, 42 through 46, and 48 are from House File 533, Representative Schultz, and these provide for Attorney General review and approval of nonprofit healthcare entity conversions and also modify language of the currently existing moratorium on HMO conversion transactions. Sections 10 to 11, 13 to 15, 22 and 24 are from Representative Liebling's 1378, requiring HMOs to be nonprofit corporations. Sections 16 to 21, 25 to 30, 40, and 41 are from House File 551, establishing additional requirements related to network adequacy. Sections 31 and 33 are from House File 1340, Representative Lean, regarding mental health parity. Sections 32 and 37 are from Representative Cantrell's House File 2009, prohibiting the use of step therapy for metastatic cancer. And sections 34 to 36 are from House File 936, Representative Halverson, providing for coverage for contraceptive methods and services.
Thank you very much. Okay, so Article 14.
Madam Chair and members, Articles 14 through 18 in this bill all come from House File 90. So starting with Article 14, this is the Resident Rights and Consumer Protections article, prohibits retaliation in nursing homes, prohibits retaliation in deceptive marketing and business practices at housing with services establishments, and establishes several consumer rights and protections for assisted living facility residents.
Okay, Article 15.
Article 15 was from House File 90, Article 4 of that bill, and this article creates health department authority to regulate certain aspects of independent senior living facilities. The commissioner is authorized to investigate violations of residency and service contracts and issue correction orders. This article establishes requirements for those contracts and provides for termination of contracts, establishes requirements for managers, and establishes certain physical environment requirements.
Okay. And Article 16.
Article 16 is the assisted living licensure article. This is from Article 5 of House File 90. And this article just very generally establishes licensure of assisted living facilities and covers kind of a comprehensive range of topics on that issue.
Okay. Article 17.
Article 17 establishes additional requirements for assisted living facilities with dementia care. There, under assisted living licensure, there will be two types of facilities that are licensed. One is assisted living facilities, and a second type is assisted living facilities that specifically provide dementia care. And so this article establishes additional requirements for that second type of facilities, requiring them to demonstrate capacity to operate the facility, providing for relinquishment of a license, establishing additional administration requirements, staffing requirements and staff training, and requirements for services.
And Article 18.
Article 18 contains House File 90, Articles 8 and 9. The language from Article 8 is in Sections 5 to 8 and 25. These are the requirements for administrators. And the remainder of the article is conforming changes to other statutes related to establishment of assisted living licensure.
And finally, Article 19.
And Madam Chair and members, Article 19 is the miscellaneous article. So sections 1 to 2 of this article are from House File 1110, Representative Zerwas, and this makes changes to early learning scholarships. Sections 3 to 8 are from House File 1888, Representative Morrison, and these include psychiatric residential treatment facilities and special education requirements. Section 9 is from House File 684, Representative Mann. This requests that the University of Minnesota establish an advisory council on rare diseases. And Section 10 is from House File 1043, Representative Cantrell. It modifies housing support rates for residents residing in certain facilities.
All right. Thank you very much. Any clarifying questions that members have at this point? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that in Article 19, modifying early learning scholarships, isn't that an educational issue or what?
Okay, Ms. Clarkus, can you address that? I assume that that must have been in Representative Pinto's report.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, that's my understanding, that it was part of Representative Pinto's committee report, but I can confirm that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Okay, and I would just note for members that we've covered, as we've gone through this, I'm sure you've probably noticed that Representative Schultz's bill, House File 90, takes up a lot of real estate in this. And in fact, it's about 200 pages of our bill is her bill, House File 90, and members may recognize, too, that bill in a different form, granted, was also one that moved through last year that didn't make it. So part of what we are doing this year is picking up and finishing some work that had been begun in the last biennium, just to note for members. So with that, we are going to start with Commissioner Malcolm is going to make a brief presentation, and then we're going to hear from Deputy Commissioners Claire Wilson and Chuck Johnston from the Department of Human Services, and then we have a list of testifiers from the public who want to testify today. So we're going to start with the agencies, then we'll go to the public testimony, and it is our intention when we get through the list of people who've signed up to testify today that is when we will break. So, and then we'll take up public testimony, further testimony tomorrow. So, okay, yeah, and it is our intention to go right now, see how much we get through, but at least until 5 p.m., so just so members are aware. Okay, welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill, and I can be pretty brief. I just want to say a very, very significant and sincere thank you to the committee for what I think is an extremely well-balanced set of strategies to improve the health of Minnesotans, and just really, really appreciate all the committee's time and attention to these issues. With all that we know about what drives healthcare costs and what determines health outcomes, as you've heard me say before, I think making prevention a larger priority in our health policy and our health financing strategies not only makes good health sense, it makes good fiscal sense for the state and for our families and our businesses as well. Prevention saves money, prevention saves time, and it saves lives, as you've heard me say before. That's why I'm so grateful to see so many of the administration's public health priorities included in the bill, and I certainly recognize the committee has much work ahead of us, but to be so responsive to the governor and lieutenant governor's recommendations is really gratifying. We're still looking over the spreadsheet to review additional items that the bill includes beyond the governor's budget, but I just would briefly say, again, I appreciate the attention to these important public health issues from members. I want to comment just on a few of the main topics. The Vulnerable Adults Protection Package, as Madam Chair just explained, by adopting a new licensing system and some strengthened consumer protections outlined in this bill and in House File 90, we will take a major step forward to create more of a prevention strategy to assure that maltreatment of all forms is prevented to the greatest degree possible and lead to a stronger system of care for our loved ones. I really want to thank Representative Schultz, Representative Liebling for their great deal of time spent in this area and for their commitment to fully fund the governor's budget request for both the critical operations improvements that we need in order to continue the important work recommended by the legislative auditor last year to fulfill our obligations under current law, as well as the important regulatory reform proposal. In the drinking water area, keeping our drinking water safe is such a fundamental task for state and local government, and when we fail to do this right, we know it has huge health and financial consequences as communities around the nation are discovering so painfully. And I'm really grateful for the inclusion of the really modest but very necessary increase to the safe drinking water fee, which will enable us to remain in a very proactive approach in working with public water suppliers and avoid shifting costs and technical assistance burden to those public water suppliers, cities, and many small business owners. With respect to suicide prevention, suicide rates are going up in Minnesota at the same unacceptable rapid pace as deaths from alcohol, opioids, and other drugs, including methamphetamines. Every death from suicide is a family and community loss that we mourn and wish we could have prevented. And we believe we can do more to prevent deaths by suicide. This bill builds upon a strong public-private partnership to expand, strengthen, sustain community-based suicide prevention across our state and rebuilds a state-based crisis response call system. It's my hope that with these investments, we can start to really turn the tide on reducing the rates of suicide across Minnesota, saving more families from painful losses. In the tobacco cessation area, thank you for making investments in what is still, despite all of our years of progress, still, tobacco use is the top cause of preventable disease and death in Minnesota. This investment in moving the statewide tobacco cessation quit line from Clearway to MDH will allow Minnesota to continue to provide important tobacco cessation counseling and nicotine replacement therapies and to continue to promote these activities to increase public awareness. Also, beyond the MDH budget, I just want to take a moment to thank you and to thank Representative Edelson for including a commitment to moving the state at the state level, raising the age of tobacco purchase to 21, and also Representative Halverson for the wisdom of directing any litigation recoveries under the Tobacco Settlement Fund to health improvement purposes and tobacco prevention. Additional high-value prevention services in the family planning arena. The governor has been very concerned by federal policy decisions that will impact health care services for women in Minnesota, and so we appreciate the inclusion of increases to family planning special project grants in our state. With respect to the Community Solutions Fund, this is an important strategy to build community prosperity by building on community assets and strengthening community voice of those communities most affected by health disparities so that they are at the table in designing solutions, particularly in the arena of early child development. And this is directly responsive to the requests from communities of color and the American Indian communities to have a strategy like this, to invest directly in their capacity building. And we're grateful for the inclusion in the bill. In the Healthcare Access Fund, I very much appreciate the inclusion of the governor's recommendation to eliminate the sunset provision for the provider tax. We've talked at length about the significant things that this funding mechanism assures and keeps stable in our state with respect to access to care for Minnesotans, but also initiatives to improve the affordability and effectiveness of that care and to continue our statewide prevention work. Also, really want to thank you for including some of the governor's recommendations for infrastructure improvements that are far beneath the headlines but are extremely important investments in our public health capacity in Minnesota. We appreciate the additional funding for the Office of Medical Cannabis to meet the growing demand for these services and by better matching the fee revenues coming into the program with appropriations to the department to be able to meet the demands for service support and research and evaluation that are really the cornerstone of this program. In addition, the policy changes that you have included in this bill will do more to help protect patient privacy, improve patient access, and give us more options for regulation and oversight of our two manufacturers. With the public health laboratory investments that you're making in equipment, you're helping us to take an important step forward to make sure we can keep this public health laboratory at the leading edge in the nation. the network adequacy provisions, our regulatory responsibilities in this arena for assuring that health plans meet network adequacy standards is very much appreciated. It's time for us to increase our efforts in this arena, and appreciate Chair Liebling's additional recommendations in this regard as well. Finally, I appreciate the inclusion of the operating adjustment for the department that simply recognizes the reality that operating costs do increase, and despite our ongoing efforts, which we pledge to continue to make to get more efficient in our efforts, failure to keep pace with cost increases does eventually catch up with us in terms of reduced capacity to respond to public health emergencies and our many regulatory duties. Also not in the MDH budget, but I really want to also thank Representative Halverson for her leadership on the family and medical leave provisions, and want to just restate that I think this is an extraordinary opportunity to improve maternal and child health and to close racial equity gaps in our state. So as I conclude, Madam Chair, I just want to thank you again for all the time that you have spent on these issues and your strong validation of the importance of prevention strategies. We spend the percentage of funds that we spend on chronic diseases in healthcare just keeps growing and growing and growing. It's now over 80% of all healthcare spending that is spent on diseases that are preventable to a great degree, and certainly can be mitigated and ameliorated by prevention even after conditions emerge. So these are the diseases that we must be focused on, and we must be focused on doing more to keep people from getting these diseases at all, or certainly delaying onset of these diseases to the greatest degree possible. We know we have to confront the growing healthcare cost burden on our state budget, for local budgets, and for businesses, and for families, as more and more of the cost has shifted to individuals paying higher premiums and higher out-of-pocket costs. But we have to do so in a sustainable way, a way that doesn't simply shift costs between types of insurers or segments of the insurance market, or from insurers to consumers' out-of-pocket obligations. Nor can we afford to simply shift costs from insurance coverage to uncompensated care. I truly believe that smart, evidence-based investments in prevention are one of our best ways to make sustainable reductions in healthcare costs over the long term, and most importantly, to keep Minnesotans healthier and more productive and living the lives that they so much want to be able to achieve their dreams. So I thank you again, Madam Chair and members, for your hard work and for your balanced and far-sighted investments in the health of Minnesotans. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Malcolm. We appreciate your time. And, of course, we make you hang out in this room quite a bit while we do other things. And thank you for taking the time to do that and sticking with us. And I assume that we will see maybe some of your staff or you when we do markup, so that if there are issues that pop up, we'll have some. You'll be there as a resource for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so I guess I misspoke before, so we don't have Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner Johnson, but we do have Deputy Commissioner Claire Wilson. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. My name's Claire Wilson. I'm just one half of the deputy dynamic duo at the Department of Human Services, though the prettier half. just kidding, Chuck. Just kidding. I also just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to provide some comments on the Health and Human Services Omnibus Budget Bill. As Commissioner Malcolm said, we, of course, also just saw the bill, so we are busy reviewing the other provisions. But I really, of course, also have to start off by thanking you, Chair Liebling, and others for bringing forward an omnibus budget bill that includes so many of the governor's priorities, and also just thank everyone in the community who's worked so hard on these provisions throughout the course of the last year. So these investments will, of course, strengthen access to health care and human services for the over 1 million Minnesotans who are served by DHS. And I also just have to say that we do believe that it will also move us closer to ending the alarming disparities that are faced by so many members of our community and Minnesotans. So I also will just take a few minutes to highlight a few of the investments. The first, of course, being in the health care. Your bill includes a package that does stay true to the governor's recommendation to repeal the provider tax sunset and invest in the One Care package for Minnesotans. As we know, these efforts will further stabilize coverage in the marketplace while providing more comprehensive and affordable care options for Minnesotans. The second investment I want to highlight is in the area of our aging adults and vulnerable adults. Thank you for including the governor's package of proposals that will help improve the quality of care for seniors and other vulnerable adults living in our assisted living and nursing home facilities. This, of course, includes the MARC system changes, the assisted living report card, the value-based reimbursement for payments to nursing facilities, and then, of course, staffing for the ombudsman. It is also something for which we are very grateful to see the ongoing investments and on the priority that you've put on the welfare of Minnesota's children and families. So thank you for including the governor's recommendations that the state invest in child care for our families through the state CCAP program. Currently, this program serves 30,000 children. These investments and changes to state law will improve the program, update the rates to providers, and eliminate the wait list for over 1,000 families. Your bill also notably includes the increase for the infant cash assistance, and just again, the first increase since 1986. So for that, we are profoundly grateful. It also invests in child welfare with the establishment of a child welfare training academy, implementation of the Federal Family First Preservation Act, and the expansion of the tribal child welfare initiatives. I also do want to take a minute to also thank you for including the program integrity measures. So this includes, of course, the proposals for the CCAP program that are needed to help DHS improve its work with providers and families to better detect and eliminate fraud in the system. Thank you also for including some of our other important integrity efforts, such as reducing provider and recipient fraud in other programs and improving the integrity of our NEMT program for Medicaid. Another key area of investment, of course, is in disability services. So thank you for including in your package the governor's recommendations for improving the disability services programs for Medicaid beneficiaries and providers with the Waiver Reimagine proposal, with the DWRS competitive workforce factor, and then other workforce investments. This is going to go a long way to addressing the workforce shortage crisis that we are facing. Other critical investments include investments in our behavioral health care system. So your bill includes the governor's recommendations for improving our behavioral health care system, including investments in SchoolLink mental health and children's residential mental health services. It also continues and expands the successful model of certified community behavioral health clinics in Minnesota, which has and will provide coordinated care for substance use disorder and mental illness. Thank you also for including and supporting critical investments and changes needed to address the opioid epidemic. We are going to look forward to working with you over the next few weeks as we bring the House and the Senate positions together on both these issues. I will just say that, the governor does feel like the traditional healing grants are a major factor in addressing the opioid crisis, so we will hope to see those included as we move forward. Other important items I just want to thank you for, including investments in our direct care and treatment programs, and then also our proposals that ensure federal compliance for our various programs at DHS, like the outpatient pharmacy drug rule for Medicaid and durable medical equipment providers, as well as bolstering our fraud prevention efforts by our counties. Overall, of course, this package just represents an incredible strong and investment and commitment to the care and services provided by DHS. I will just mention, I would be remiss if I did not just mention that the bill does not fully fund the systems investment that the governor had proposed. The full investment of $20 million for the upcoming biennium would be utilized to modernize our technology systems at DHS. And really, this is critical for us to be able to move forward into a person-centered human services delivery system and to really transform what we're currently doing by addressing the groundwork for, business and planning needs. So we'll continue to work with you all on that. But overall, I just thank you again for your time today, for the commitment and investment that you've made, and we will look forward to working with you through conference committee.
All right. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Baker, I know you want to ask a question. We're really not going to do questions now. If you have something you want to clarify, it would be okay, but we're not going to. And as we do the public testimony, we're not going to stop and ask.
Okay, I just want a question. Will Ms. Wilson be available for other questions later on, I guess, because of the – okay, I'm going to not from the CA.
That's Representative fine. Baker, I think, and I don't know about Deputy Commissioner Wilson specifically, but when we have our markup, we will have agency staff here to ask questions and to use as a resource, as we always do when we're considering bills and amendments.
Very good.
So we will have that. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. Okay. So I think at this point, I understand that our House research staff is going to go and continue their work, and I just want to once again say, and members will hear me say this a lot, they do incredible work, and every one of you who goes to one of them for an amendment or for advice about a bill or an amendment, please realize that they're also doing that same work for every other member. So each of us sees only a small little piece of what they do, and yet they manage to juggle these incredible workloads. I know some of them, like many of us, have been sick this session, and yet they've persevered. And so I think that, their work isn't done. We probably shouldn't thank them yet, really, because they've got a lot more to do. But, you know, all of this, all of these pages, you know, have been written, put together, looked over, explained by them, and this place just would not function were it not for their incredible hard work and expertise. So I think we really owe them a vote of gratitude here. So thank you so much. So with that, we will turn to public testimony. And again, now, members, unlike what we did when we heard the governor's budget, we did not ask to group the testifiers under any particular topics. And as you know, there are a lot of topics in this bill. So what I will do is, as the testifiers come up, and I'm going to ask you to be efficient in your testimony, we're asking you to do 2 minutes, but knowing that we're all looking at the whole bill, I would ask the testifiers to first, as you start, not only give us your name and your affiliation as you normally would, but please tell us what in the bill you are testifying on, because otherwise by the time we figure that out, we may not be able to listen to you because we'll all be looking to figure out what you're talking about. So give us that little orientation as you come up, and that will make your testimony, I hope, a little more useful to us. So we will start then with Dominic McQuarrie. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was not expecting to be first up, so I feel a little bit like the first person to the party. Tried to show up fashionably late, but for the record, I'm Dominic McQuarrie, Public Policy Manager at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation, and would like to thank the committee and the chair for its acknowledgement and the needs for investments in time and money to our mental health system through items like certified community behavioral health clinics, schooling to mental health, and the Uniform Service Standards Reform effort. And additionally, would like to thank them for their investment in families through the CCAP program and MFIP. But in order to keep my remarks brief, we'll be submitting a letter with a fuller response that breaks it out by section. But I also serve as the co-convener for the This Is Medicaid Coalition and must mention Article 8, Section 39 on page 543 of this bill, which is the repealer of the provider tax. No one would say that our healthcare system is perfect, and if we did, many of us in this room would not be here today and tomorrow and the next day. But that being said, Minnesota has long been a standard bearer when it comes to coverage and quality. And without this repealer, it's hard for me to see how we wouldn't take a step back in coverage and quality, let alone make the changes that we need to provide the quality of care that Minnesotans deserve. So we just like to say that the many great things that are in House File 2414 And the other committee bills that are being released over the coming weeks are in many ways built upon the repealer that's in this bill. So we want to say that This Is Medicaid is in full support of the step taken by this bill to preserve the funding for the Health Care Access Fund through the time-tested, court-tested, and reliable source known as the provider tax, and hope that others will join us in our support for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Abderholen,
welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. At first, I thought you were going to do it alphabetically, well, then I would have been first.
And folks, I do have an agenda. I believe this has been produced for everyone, so the list is on it. So that's what I'm following, unless there's some reason to deviate. So please go ahead.
Mainly, I'm going to be obviously talking about mental health. We appreciate the step therapy override, the dispute resolution for counties and state operated services, the continuation of the certified community behavioral health clinics, the funding for the psychiatric residential treatment facilities and children's residential, the schooling to mental health increases, transition to community. I'm really pleased to see the MFIP child-only child care provision in there. I've been working on that for about 6 years, so thank you. The Competency Restoration Task Force, the funding for homeless youth, really pleased to see the suicide prevention increases. That has not happened for many years. We support repeal of the provider tax. Really pleased to see the inclusion of the mental health parity language along with stronger network adequacy standards. I will say that we are still reading through the bill. It was hard to do on my phone. We have sent already some suggested language to the department on the uniform standards. This is a huge undertaking. We're going through it with a fine-tooth comb, so we will be coming back with some things to really increase the accountability of the crisis teams. And we are also going through with a fine-tooth comb the waivered services issues. Anytime you try to cover everyone the same, usually someone gets left out, and it's usually the mental health community. So we may be coming back with some language changes there. While overall we are very thrilled about the investment in mental health, we wish you could have put some money for the First Episode program. As you know, it's a great way to prevent schizophrenia from becoming disabling. And as you know, the rate increases for mental health providers has not happened in some time. That is a huge part of our funding. About 10% of the funding for our mental health system comes from grants, and the rest really from both Medicaid and private insurance. And then just lastly, we know in terms of the workforce issues, we too hope that the opioid bill will be able to fund the Native American healers, and at some point in the future perhaps we can look at upping the loan forgiveness program. But truly, thank you. As you know, mental health is a huge issue in our state. Our system isn't broken. We just need to continue to build it, and we appreciate the efforts that you took today.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholen. And one clarifying question I have. You said the repeal of the provider tax. Did you mean the sunset?
Yes, sorry.
The repeal of the sunset.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I was just trying to rattle right down this list to make it in 2 minutes.
I wanted to be sure that I was hearing it right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Amanda Jansen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Amanda Jansen with Clearway Minnesota and Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation Coalition. I'm here to speak to the tobacco provisions in Article 12. We must do more to reduce tobacco's harm in Minnesota. Despite our progress, too many adults are still addicted, and too many young people are being lured by the tobacco industry's aggressive tactics. For the first time in 17 years, youth tobacco use rates have increased due to skyrocketing e-cigarette use, and our adult smoking rate has stalled at 14%. Three provisions in this bill will help tobacco users quit and keep kids from ever getting addicted in the first place. First, we support the proposed funding for quit smoking services to ensure Minnesota does not become the only state not providing these services. Next, we support increasing the tobacco age to 21 to reduce youth tobacco use. I was just in Olmsted County this morning, and I'm happy to report that Olmsted County is Minnesota's 31st Tobacco 21 community. It's time to take this policy statewide. Third, we support dedicating delinquent tobacco settlement fees to health. This is a smart investment for our state that will help us continue the work of preventing youth tobacco use for years to come. There's one proposal we would like to see added to the bill, Chair Halverson's House File 349. The proposal would strengthen our clean indoor air law by prohibiting e-cigarette use where smoking is banned. This is an overwhelmingly popular policy that passed off the House floor this year with 100 votes, but the Senate has not yet acted on the Senate file. Minnesota can do more to protect children from a lifetime of addiction and disease and to help those already addicted quit for good. These policies will address tobacco addiction from all angles, and we're grateful to you, Chair Liebling, for addressing these life-saving policies in your bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Carissa Kemp, welcome.
My name is Carissa Kemp, and I'm with the Minnesota Dental Association, and I'm testifying in support of the Uniform Administrator for Dental Services in the One Care portion. The Minnesota Dental Association supports the proposal for a Uniform Administrator for Dental Benefits under Medical Assistance and Minnesota Care. The MDA has advocated this change for several years, and we are very pleased that Governor Walz and the House HHS Committee has included this dental reform in their biennial budgets. A uniform administration of public programs would greatly assist in addressing the lack of access to dental care. It would replace a system with nine separate administrative systems, all with different criteria and payments. It would allow for a single credentialing system for all dental providers who wish to provide care to state program patients. It would establish a single prior authorization system for care, which will give providers a greater sense of what services would be approved. It would set up a single reimbursement system that would replace the confusing and complicated reimbursement scheme we have produced over the last decade. It would give the legislature and the dental community greater transparency related to when and where state assets are being expended and where targeted assistance may be needed to improve access to dental care in the state. Lastly, it would provide proof to the federal government that the state is aggressively attempting to improve access to children for dental care. I would like to thank Chair Liebling for her championing this issue now and in the past, and encourage the committee to accept the proposal for a uniform administration of state dental programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Tom Lehman.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Per Chair Liebling's directive, at the very beginning, I just want to say I'll be referencing Article 12, Section 68, which is at lines at page 730.10. But before I get there, Madam Chair, here on behalf of Minnesota Medical Solutions, one of the two medical cannabis manufacturers.
Please say your name.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Tom Lehman, on behalf of Minnesota Medical Solutions. We want to thank you for including Representative Edelson's medical cannabis bill, House File 766, in this bill. Her bill includes multiple provisions to help address access and cost issues in the medical cannabis program. It also includes appropriating funds to the Office of Medical Cannabis from the Special Revenue Fund, as you heard Commissioner Malcolm reference. It's not often that organizations come before the legislature and say, please increase funding so our regulator can hire more staff to oversee us, but we think that's appropriate. The number of patients that the office serves has tripled over the last number of years since the program started, but it has received no increase in funding. And the funds that are in your bill will allow patients to get their enrollment cards processed much faster and will allow persons calling with questions about the program to not have to wait on hold. I do want to mention the one issue of small concern, and again, that relates to Article 12, Section 68 at line 730. If you look at that, you'll see that this original language related to transporting cannabis and required medical cannabis manufacturer could transport medical cannabis with only one employee if they're transporting medical cannabis either to a lab for testing or the processed material to a composting or burn site, which we think is fine. And if they're transporting medical cannabis for other purposes, they needed two people in the car. And that's how we've been operating and the other manufacturers operating as well. That's appropriate to make sure there's not diversion. When this provision was drafted, and again, I think this came from Representative Vang's bill that was added to the bill, and it was drafted with input from the Department of Agriculture. I think they just added the word hemp after the word cannabis there, so that if a medical cannabis manufacturer is transporting hemp for purposes other than testing or disposal, they need two employees in the vehicle. That's an administrative cost that we have some questions about. There's not a black market, if you will, for hemp. There's not a risk of it being diverted and processed into something other than carpeting and in our case, CBD. So we just have some questions about that. We've talked to the health department about this. They understand our concerns, and we hope to find some common ground on this issue as your bill goes forward, again, to help try and reduce administrative costs. But again, Madam Chair, we appreciate your support for the medical cannabis program and your support for the thousands of patients that are benefiting from the medicines that the two manufacturers are producing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. All right. We've got Sarah Grafstrom.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am here today representing ARM and our over 150 provider organization members who provide home and community-based services to individuals with disabilities. I'm going to be speaking specifically to the competitive workforce factor and the language around increased fees for 245D providers. So first and foremost, we want to express our gratitude to the chair and this committee for the inclusion of a competitive workforce factor in the disability waiver rate system and the ongoing adjustments that are included. Specifically, thank you to Representative Schultz for her work on this provision. Our direct support professional workforce is the backbone of everything we do. And as you're all aware, recent data shows that DSP wages fall 17% lower than wages of occupations with similar education and training requirements. The competitive workforce factor is an important step in beginning to address this wage gap. While we are grateful for the important steps taken with the competitive workforce factor, we do have concerns and opposition over the language that is included that would increase licensing fees for 245D providers. Analysis of this proposal among ARM members shows an average increase in fees of 61%, with fee increases for individual providers ranging from 20% to 300%. Our members are dedicated to providing the highest quality of services to individuals with disabilities. We understand and support the need to have appropriate licensing visits. However, a fee increase this drastic will be very problematic to providers. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Toby Pearson. Welcome to the committee. And Ms. Thurlow.
Madam Chair, members, Toby Pearson, Care Providers of Minnesota. Today on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative, I will be specifically addressing the proposed cuts to nursing homes. As you know,
there are none of those in the bill, you know.
Madam Chair, members, there actually are. As you know, the new payment system was implemented for nursing facilities on January 1st, 2016. The new system replaced system that had chronically underfunded nursing homes for 20 years. Under this proposal, the nursing homes will lose more than $200 million in funding, $68 million from the state budget, a matching dollar from federal money, and because of rate equalization, a matching private pay dollar. That cut is in this biennium alone. These cuts will have the greatest impact on wages, benefits, and training, which comprise about 65% of nursing home costs. The proposed changes are in spite of the fact that the Department of Human Services' own report states that changes to value-based reimbursement system are premature because trends in spending, access, and workforce are developing. We agree. Those changes are premature. With just over 2 years since its start date, we believe it's premature to make significant changes to VBR until enough data and experience is collected. Nursing facilities have made significant investments to their employees. Increases such as CNA wages going up 26%, LPNRN wages going up over 20%, full-time employees covered by employer-sponsored health insurance increasing by 10%. Despite this, we continue to struggle with workforce issues and a net loss of CNAs. The proposed cuts come in several ways. First, the changes to the care-related limits and quality score. While we applaud the direction of increasing the incentives to quality, in our opinion, the blunt instrument approach taken in the governor's proposal is not acceptable. The use of quality measures to establish cost limits is an integral part of VBR. However, assessing outcomes and proposing changes based on the 12 months of data is premature. Also, using Medicare regions instead of the One Minnesota approach that we previously have will bring about regional disparities and adversely affect rural providers. Second, with only 2 years of activity, it's difficult to assume any trends. Therefore, we expect the growth in other operating to mitigate over time. Capping increases at this time and changes to other operating will adversely affect key nursing home employees, including maintenance, and other non-direct care employees who are essential to the operations of a nursing home.
Mr. Pearson, we need you to kind of wrap up.
But there's so many joyful proposals here.
Well, you'll have to deal with them.
Third property, should not be expected that we should change property at this point. We should have a longer look at that. In the midst of a $100 billion surplus, cuts to long-term care do not make sense.
Thank you. Ms. Thurlow, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'll be speaking to two issues, first related to the Vulnerable Adult Protection and Assisted Living licensure provisions in Articles 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18, and then secondly to the swing bed expansion found in Article 12, Section 11 of the bill. With regard to the first issue on Vulnerable Adult Protection and Assisted Living licensure, I want to first say thank you for including funding for the ombudsman. We do support that and are pleased to see that concept included in the bill. There are many additional concepts that we support in the bill, but as of this time, we do not support the overall details of the bill and continue to work with the stakeholders. For example, while we support the movement towards a single assisted living licensure framework this year, there are several worrisome details included in this provision. For example, we know that under the language in the bill, it would invalidate almost every management contract that currently exists to run assisted living facilities in the state. This is problematic to us. It would make Medicaid participation for assisted living providers mandatory, which seems contrary to a Minnesota Supreme Court decision regarding provider participation in Medicaid. And it would increase licensure fees in the out year starting in fiscal year 2022 by over $13 million a year, and that's on page 20, line 790 of the spreadsheet. We support electronic monitoring, but know that we still have continued conversations about provider notification. We support enhancements to anti-retaliation and deceptive marketing, but have expressed concerns here as well. So we remain committed to working with the stakeholders, but have several concerns. Now on to the second issue with regard to swing beds. As we testified in this committee last week, we are concerned that the proposal to increase the swing bed limit to 9,125 days goes too far. And as we shared in testimony, we think that it will harm small, rural, local nursing homes financially, potentially undermining access and availability to those in local communities. It will increase Medicare spending because it does cost significantly more, up to four times more to serve someone in a swing bed as it does in a nursing home, and it could potentially undermine choice, as we heard from our testifier last week. We remain committed to continuing conversations. We understand that these are complex issues, but again, we think this provision goes too far. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Danny Ackert. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Danny Ackert. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, representing Minnesota's 17 federally qualified health centers, also referred to as FQHCs. We strongly support House File 2414 as amended, specifically provisions in Article 8, Sections 26, 35, and 38, included from House File 725 in the Governor's Supplemental Budget that establishes an alternative payment methodology for FQHCs and rural health clinics. The proposed alternative payment methodology will both deepen and expand the comprehensive, cost-saving, and one-stop-shop access to primary medical, dental, and behavioral health care services for rural and urban underserved communities and patients that FQHCs and rural health clinics serve statewide. Further, we also strongly support the inclusion of numerous primary care and prevention-based provisions, including the expansion of certified community behavioral health clinics, the expansion and strengthening of school-linked mental health, funding for the statewide tobacco cessation quit line, raising the tobacco age to 21, and maintaining the provider tax and the healthcare access fund. Madam Chair, members, we are truly grateful to this committee and the HHS Policy Committee for the work put forth on House File 725 and the inclusion of FQHCs and rural health clinics in House File 2414. We are also grateful to the Governor and the Lieutenant Governor and the Department of Human Services for their support and guidance. Again, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your work and support of FQHCs and for your dedication to a stronger and more robust network of comprehensive primary care access for Minnesotans statewide. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Eckert. Jessica Webster.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here in support of the Bill 2414. There's so much good in this bill, but I just wanted to briefly talk today about MFIP.
Okay, don't forget to say your name.
Jessica Webster, staff attorney with Legal Aid. Thank you. So we're excited about MFIP. This is a $100 a month investment for families. It hasn't been increased since 1986. And I think we did hear bills ranging from $100 to $600 a month, and I think that this is a great start, and I hope that we can continue to have this conversation about catching MFIP up to inflation, but this is a really awesome investment in babies, children, their parents, and people striving toward employment. The one thing that we didn't see in this bill was anything around sanction reform. I understand there was probably not space this year to address sanctions. If there is one thing that this committee can still consider a small thing, it would be making sure that parents who are drug tested and show signs of chemical dependency or substance use disorder, we'd like those folks to be treated the same as folks who are facing a more compassionate approach across the state in terms of opioid abuse and chemical dependency. So repealing some of those sanctions. The fiscal note I saw was about $150,000 to repeal those drug testing sanctions. So in terms of the MFIP cash grant, if you did a $99 MFIP cash grant, that $1 change could pay for repealing these drug testing sanctions for families. And we think that'd be a really good investment in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Kirsten Anderson.
Madam Chair.
Welcome members of the committee.
Thank you. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, an association of children's service providers statewide. Thank you so much for your thoughtful leadership in composing this omnibus bill. Many significant investments in this bill are so good for kids and families. The children's and mental intensive mental health investments, foster care licensing, homeless youth, safe harbor investments, and so much more. We are truly grateful. Today I'm here to share a grave concern relating to the lack of investment in the foundation of our mental health system, our community-based mental health rates. With a demonstrated 25% gap between the MA reimbursement for services and costs, our providers are not surprisingly struggling. For some small providers, acquisitions and closures are now on the table, as all other solutions have run their course. Grant funding, charitable giving, cost cutting, it has its limits. Larger providers are also taxed for reviewing if mental health can be maintained as a continued loss leader for service delivery. Providers are committed. Like you, they are focused on impact, the work of helping kids and families get better. And we've come to you and studied the issue together. A study funded in 2015 finally was delivered to you in December from Mercer Consulting discussing the great needs to address rates. The Children's Intensive Mental Health Study of 2019 also addresses mental health rights as a priority. The Mental Health Workforce Study of 2015 brings forward the importance of rates. The Governor's Task Force on Mental Health Report of 2016 includes rates as a priority. So no more study is needed. We are in a perilous and unsustainable path for our mental health service delivery system, and at the very same moment that we are calling on it to do more. In 2019, this body is prioritizing mental health, and we are grateful. To deliver on shared goals for Minnesotans to access quality mental health care, we must have a community-based mental health system with the basics to do the work. We need to figure out our rates. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Katie Sly?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Katie Sly. I'm with the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I'm the legislative liaison. We at the Council recognize the tremendous work that the Chair and members have put forth to create and shape policy for a healthier Minnesota. I want to extend our deepest gratitude, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the inclusion of Representative Becker-Finn's bill, House File 479, in Article 12, Section 50 of House File 2414, the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. And in doing so, dedicating $1.5 million over the biennium for the creation of the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Program. There's currently no state funding dedicated specifically to domestic violence prevention in Minnesota. House File 479 would support community-driven and culturally relevant prevention programs throughout the state. According to the Centers for Disease Control, nearly 1 in 4 adult women and 1 in 7 men in the U.S. report having experienced severe physical violence. In some of our Asian and Pacific Islander communities, it is reported that 1 in 2 women across the nation have experienced intimate physical or sexual violence during their lifetime. At some times, and to some, those numbers may feel distant, but we at the Pacific Asian Council have seen the issue play out all too often. For example, last year in St. Paul, a family advocate working for the Karen Organization of Minnesota, serving the Karen refugee community, had a family advocate working and was killed trying to support a Karen domestic violence victim on a home visit. Since then, the Karen Organization of Minnesota has stepped back from doing crisis work on this very important issue due to lack of resources and continued threats to their staff. Our council has also received threatening messages at times because we have made gender-based violence a legislative priority. Despite these challenges, countless organizations and our council have stood our ground because we know all too well that we have no choice but continue working to secure resources to ensure that all Minnesotans are safe and free from fear and violence. The prevention program, House File 479, is a product of over 2 years of stakeholder engagement and the support of more than 200 organizations statewide, serving diverse communities, including our API, Asian and Pacific Islander-led nonprofits such as SEWA and the Karen Organization of Minnesota, and mainstream organizations such as the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women and the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Investing in prevention of domestic violence and sexual assault is morally and fiscally sound decision. And we sincerely thank you, Madam Chair and members, for including House File 479, the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Prevention Program, in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. So next we have Eric Armakonki. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Armakonki. I'm the Policy and Legislative Affairs Director for the Schultz Defense Fund of Minnesota. First and foremost, thank you to you, Chair, your staff, and all members on the committee for all the work that goes into putting an omnibus bill together. Here to testify in support of a few specific provisions related to child care assistance, MPIP, the Community Solutions Grant Program, and the provider tax. First on child care assistance, it's great to see the full federal conformity, and specifically the family-friendly federal conformity. We're one of the last states to comply, and we're on the verge of facing federal sanctions. So it's great to see this included. It's also important to see a tie down of the child care wait list. This will help parents get to work and ensure children have care. With respect to provider rates, it's an important step going up to the 2018 market rate survey. However, we do hope that this will be revisited again soon, because if we're only going up to the 2018 market rate survey, soon we will be out of compliance if we're not periodically updating, and it's important to make sure our providers have sustainable funding. And lastly, on child care assistance, we appreciate the structural adjustments to CCAP to make sure that CCAP dollars are going to families in need. On the Community Solutions Grant Program, a big thank you for including this. This provision is key to ensuring there's a strong equity component in this health and in this omnibus bill. With relation to MFIP, it's great to see the steps taken here to rectify a 33-year-long overdue investment in our children who are at risk of facing the most severe economic hardship, and we also support the MFIP child care assistance to families who have caregivers with mental illness. And then lastly, on the provider tax, we are strong supporters of this, and we're just at a moment where we feel that we can't afford to reproduce or experiment with our health care funding sources. So thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Armakonki. Jason Flores, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jason Flores. I'm the State Director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. On behalf of our activists, I'm here today to testify against the tax increases contained in this bill. Healthcare affordability and access remain top concerns among Minnesota families and businesses. For years, the state legislature has worked to address this problem. Former Governor Mark Dayton and a Republican legislature agreed to repeal the healthcare provider tax in 2011, removing unnecessary government-imposed costs from the system. By reinstating this provider tax, this committee would undo that bipartisan work and raise $750 million in new taxes every year on the backs of patients already struggling to afford the care they need. This proposal ignores a simple truth. You can't make health care more affordable by making health care cost more. The history of the tax since it was scheduled in 2011 for repeal at the end of this year is a case study in accounting gimmicks and budget shell games that highlight the real lack of transparency and accountability in healthcare funding. The legislature has repeatedly used surpluses within the Healthcare Access Fund for additional programs never intended when the tax was first imposed. In effect, Minnesotans have been paying 2% more than they should every time they get sick in order to maintain an off-book slush fund that has been raided time after time for other priorities, to replace general fund spending, or to hide funding and set up accounting gimmicks. By the end of fiscal year 2019, the Healthcare Access Fund only allocated $21 million for MinnesotaCare, the entire reason it was originally created, only a small percentage of the total $530 million cost. Before we ask Minnesotans to pay higher taxes on their own health care, we should make sure that we are being accountable for every dollar currently being spent on state programs. Yet report after report from the legislative auditor has identified hundreds of millions of dollars of waste, fraud, and abuse, including benefits going to people who never were or no longer are eligible. The bottom line, we do not need the provider tax to fund Minnesota's current, very generous public programs. Rather than funding needed care, it has only facilitated out-of-control general fund spending. Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for hearing me this afternoon and for the opportunity to share our concerns with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Right on the 2 minutes. Very good. Thank you. Laura Sales.
Welcome. Hello. My name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We are going to have a letter with more details in it that we're hoping to get to in the next day or so. But just very briefly, none of this will be a surprise to you. Thank you for removing the sunset on the provider tax. As you well know, it's an important source of funding for healthcare programs, and without it, we either have to cut those programs or take money from other parts of the budget. So thank you for that. We like the One Care provisions in the bill, including the statewide pharmacy and dental benefits. Also, the addition of the plan to direct DHS to make a plan for outpatient drug benefits for HMO enrollees. We appreciate including the governor's proposals on sex offender program, MSOX, and DCT funding. We like the whole prescription drug article, and as well as the provisions from House File 90. In the healthcare coverage article, really appreciate the HMO conversion language and the network adequacy language. And then lastly, a very small piece but important, the funding for the study of the unified healthcare financing system will give us a lot of important information about how we can fund healthcare in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So that concludes the list of people that we had signed up to testify today. If there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify right now on the bill, we will give you time to do that. Please come down. Of course, we will be taking testimony tomorrow as well. So, we are certainly doing that because we understand that everyone has not had a complete opportunity to digest what's in the bill. But Is there someone else who wants to testify? Please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel, a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. I just want to start by thanking you, Chair Liebling, for a very thoughtful first stab at an omnibus bill. Really appreciate all the work you and your staff have put into it. I'm just going to touch on six quick things. First, the provider tax, our support for that kind of pulls this whole bill together. We appreciate you repealing the repeal. The next two things are in the direct care and treatment article, specifically the state-operated community services funding and the additional funding for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Just want to note that this additional funding doesn't add any additional full-time employees. It just maintains who's currently working there. And right now it's a staff safety issue and a workplace safety issue for us. I'm worried that we'll start to see reports of additional injuries if we don't do anything, and if we don't fund this additional, or if you don't appropriate this additional funding for the current FTEs, I'm sure we will see more injuries. The next two issues I want to touch on are in Article 1, Section 43, 44, and 25 and 26. They deal with child welfare. First, the Training Academy, and second, the Child Protection Grant Allocation, changing the withholds. We support both of these proposals. I've talked before about advocating for excellence in services for the public. I think this is an issue in the last few years where we've really collectively failed at that. We've forced a lot of veteran workers out of the field. We've seen very high caseloads, and ultimately families and children have been the ones to suffer. And finally, just want to say that we are concerned with the changes to the nursing facility rates. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there someone else who wants to testify on the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee with Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and APEC, which is a housing consortium. I don't have a prepared text today. I was planning on sending it, but I'll be out of state tomorrow, so I'll just work off some notes. We're still asking that you consider, as far as some amendments to the Health and Human Services budget, as far as inclusion of the need for educating and training community families and patients on medical knowledge and ability to help serve themselves before they enter or have a need for paramedics and hospital care. The reason I'm still pushing on that, and the governor has heard the information, and I've earlier sent you some preliminary information, is that my brother died when he was around friends, and the only thing they could think of was to call 911. They didn't know CPR. They didn't know they could have saved him. And they tried resuscitating him at the hospital, but it was too late. So that's one area where families need to be, or rather friends need to be educated. The other is, I have another brother who was taking care of my father, and he didn't know stroke symptoms, so and that there was a necessity to get him to the hospital within so many hours for TPA, or else they couldn't do anything for him. So not knowing that, and even I didn't know that after helping the American Heart Association for 18 years, I didn't know the necessity of that, and my father ended up dying. So I know of other stories out there where the information is needed. So we're asking that you consider an amendment that we're still pushing for. And when they say that there's no funding, I sit on the Cultural and Ethnic Leadership Council under DHS, and we have done things as far as looking within the department for ways to make it more culturally appropriate and tweak things. And there's a number of provisions in your bill where things could be tweaked to provide the necessary education and training that families and their friends and relatives need. Caregivers, CPR, first aid, family child care training, telecom, home health services, domestic abuse, sexual assault, and the list goes on. So I'll lay that out in a future document. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify right now on this DE amendment? All right. I'm not seeing anyone. So members are just going to, and for the public, just to let you know then, after we adjourn today, so we will not be going into the night today, obviously, we will meet tomorrow at our regular time and take public testimony. And what we're going to ask members of the public to do is we're going to try to structure the testimony by article in the DE amendment. So, we'll just try this just to let people know. I believe it's more helpful to members if we take testimony kind of by topic a little bit because it's very difficult for us. I know each of the people who comes and testifies is very focused on one or a few aspects of the bill. But it's hard for members to sometimes to really understand what's being said if each testifier is talking about something completely different. So we will sort of take testimony in order of the articles in the bill. We won't be, completely strict. But if you are planning to testify tomorrow, you can look at the amendment. It's posted online. Kind of figure out where you are in the order. And then please try to come in, and we'll have that kind of loosely take that order of testifiers. I know some of you have already signed up, but we'll just try to do it that way try to make it more. We want to hear what you have to say. I know members listen to it very carefully. Much of it may end up in an amendment. Much of it may impact the bill, but this will help us make it more understandable. Anything else I need to say? Okay. So thank you very much. Oh, yeah, and for members, please be aware that we have an amendment deadline Thursday at noon. This is different for this committee. We haven't done that before in this committee. Amendments have to be submitted by noon on Thursday. And I've been asked about amendments to amendments. Just so everyone's aware, we're working off of a DE amendment. So every amendment you offer is, in fact, an amendment to an amendment already. That said, they all have to be in at noon on Thursday. If there are technical amendments as we're working through this as a committee, if there are, you need to change a date, something, you need to strike a section, I certainly will use discretion to allow that. We're not going to be as strict as we are on the floor. But all major amendments have to be submitted in writing. We're not going to, come up with things out of whole cloth here. But if you submit amendments and you are really serious about them and you need to make them work a little bit, we will certainly try to accommodate that. So with that, any questions or anything I've missed here today before we adjourn? Okay, not seeing anything. So with that, thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.